Hello, everybody. Welcome to Sonic Talk, episode 795, recorded today on the 27th of March. It's raining continuously where I am, unfortunately. I was rather hoping that now my wrist has healed, I'd be out fishing, but the weather's been against me the whole time. It's rather disappointing, but I'm going to be back out there soon. Anyway, lovely to have all our friends in the chat. Nice to see a lot of familiar faces. We've got Technomatic. Oh, nice one, Technomatic. Azzyhead, Azira, Leith, Redwalk, Switch, Chris S. Of course, Wagyu is there as ever, moderating and taking care of some of the back-end stuff that keeps the whole show rolling. Thank you very much as ever, Wagyu, very much appreciated. Just want to do a bit of housekeeping here. This is, before we get into it, I should say this is the show dedicated to music technology, all things to do with synthesizers, recording, software, live production, all that kind of stuff. I've got a problem with me cables today. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, just want to do a little bit of housekeeping about what's going on. We're streaming to LinkedIn. We'll see how that goes. This is the third week we've done that. It hasn't been an overwhelming sort of floodgates of new viewers, but hey, you know, it's free. It's no issue. And we're probably one of the only people doing it, I'd imagine. So that's probably good. Also want to remind you that, of course, the one of the founding fathers and the most beloved, sadly passed, Dom Hawkins, our studio kit is still available. If anybody is interested in helping the family out, I think they need to kind of clear the attic and sort of move on. Please, I think I can press, is it that button? I think that's the thing. As far as I can remember, it says latest news, but that's actually the link to Dot. It should have gone in the chat room. So do check that out and you can get in touch with Margaret to find out. Oh, yeah, here we go. There's a spreadsheet with the stuff that's still available. Anyway, I'll leave that to all of you. Coming up, we've also got a review of the Phantom EX, or a sort of overview of the Phantom, Roland Phantom EX, the new synthesizer components that are in the new update, which is the new ACB models and the new wavetable synth. Super Frog Save Tokyo, who you may remember from EMOM, he played a blinding set. He's doing it for us. So he said, I'll have a go. And I think he bit off more than he expected, because it's not a simple fact just doing video reviews, but well played. That'll be coming up soon. Anyway, let's get on to a couple other things. Yes, indeed. Anyway, Ty Unwin, it's been ages. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, it's been ages. I can see that there's a. I'm a bit worried about some of those synths. They look a bit precarious. There's a. What's that? Wave?
No.
Oh, what's it called? A third wave. Lovely instrument.
Third wave. Isn't it? Yeah, absolutely.
And is that a Super Gemini? Yeah.
It
Ooh,
is.
Nice.
And does nice. C50... No, hang on a minute that way. Hang on.
Oh, yeah.
C50. Oh, hello.
And then just below that...
C50, Wall of Poly.
And there's a Moog one below that. And then what nice. You can't see, that end, there's a Maximus. And a CS80.
Oh, God! Blimey. We know you've got loads of synths.
I know.
So it's just, we know, but I'm glad for you. How are you finding the Super Gemini, actually? Because the Super Gemini Lovely. Was one of the ones that's the newest. It's a real players and kind of, it's very intuitive to use, right? Lots of sweet spots.
Lots of sweet spots. And it's also, it's a proper future classic. You know, you get that feeling with certain synths that it's going to, in years to come. It's going to be one of those that, yeah, it's going to be a future classic. It's great. It really is good. And it's just a perfect combo of a kind of Jupiter 8 and a CS80 from a user interface point of view, all wrapped into one. And it's just so easy to just get stuff out of it. And for me, that's so important. But it's the same with the third wave. It's so easy just to get stuff out of it, because we've had far too long where it's not, you know, it's a bit of a ball ache to try and find those sweet spots, but they're everywhere on these things. So really good.
Nice. Oh, excellent. Well, glad to hear it. Lovely to have you. Nice of you to give us some of your free time. I know it's about, are you through the thicker? Cause I know you were in the thick of sort of dense projects and it was kind of like, have you got the worst of it or are you still?
I got over those. No. And then I had a bit of time taking it easy for a bit, but I'm now just starting on a big BBC series for the next 12 months that I'm on that's coming out middle of next year. So I'm just starting on that, but I can't say what it is. But it's quite a big one, but it's good. So I'm just starting on that now, and that's seeing me through till next March. So
excellent. Well, it's always good to see BBC license players' money going on actual new content and proper kind of production. So very nice.
Exactly.
Very nice.
So. Yeah. All good.
Good. I approve. And we've also got Richard Nichols back from Pittsburgh Modular there with his, what are we seeing there? Is that an Electron Rhythm? And of course, the Tiger Desktop, which you released some time back. How's that all going? Are you overwhelmed with the joy it's bringing your customers?
Yeah, it's nice to anytime you release anything, it's nice to get feedback because, you know, you sort of work in a bubble for years on something and then you get it out there and it's nice to hear people say, oh, I like this, or wow, I'm using it like this in ways that you hadn't thought of. So it's always a joy to get stuff out to the world. And it's
absolutely
also a big stress release.
I can imagine. Thank goodness. The boat is on the water. The Suez Canal is open. Everything is happy. Or I guess that would be probably affect you before you finish the production. But yeah, all of those things you never thought you'd worry about. You know, it's just like, wow. Anyway, lovely to have you, Richard. Pleasure as ever. And of course, popping over back across the Atlantic, we've got Polly, Magical Synth Adventure. I did have that button. I can't find the song. I spent ages making a specific sample to play Magical Synth Adventure, and I've lost it in the and I can't find it anymore. I have to do it again. How are you? You doing good?
I'm not bad, thanks. So we're on 795, didn't you say? Episode 795?
Yes, we are.
The Yamaha PSS 795.
Oh,
was
really?
The first MIDI keyboard I ever had.
Oh,
It's like a little sort of, you know, toy keyboard with MIDI, but it had a tiny vector joystick on it. How about that? So you could actually morph between four PCM samples. You couldn't MIDI control that or anything, I don't think, but, you know, I was, 12 years old or something, so I didn't really care. I was just there making, you know, cool sounds.
I'm trying to find a link that I can post.
showing its age, I think one of the preset styles on it was New Jack Swing, which really dates that instrument.
There it is. Oh, hold on. We're on reverb, so it's loaded. This is what it looks like. Let's see what they're going for. £215.97. Look at that.
The 90 is slightly more colourful than the 795, but the same instrument, essentially. I'm good. I'm good. And I got sent something cool for free this week, which is cool. One of my best friends is moving out of the area, which is sad, but she was looking in a loft and found this really old 1960s Philips dynamic microphone, and I thought looks really cool. It's like
that's for dictation, isn't it?
Bakelite or something.
Yeah.
Wow. So I'm gonna plug it in and see what it sounds like.
What's the connection? Is it one of those really bizarre, like kind of not quite a DIN plug, not quite a jack plug? Yeah.
Yes, it's a 3-pin DIN.
Oh, maybe it's MIDI.
So good look. Maybe it is, but it does have a female 3-pin DIN to a mini jack included.
Oh, look at that.
So I'll be
that
all right.
Future proof.
Yeah, wild. Yeah, it is.
Oh, nice.
Well, we can tell you what it's going to sound like. We can tell you what it's going to sound like. Crap. But yeah, that's part
terrible.
Of
it. It will sound
that's,
dreadful.
That's part of the appeal.
So, yeah, exactly.
Excellent.
It'll I'm not going to do it in a shootout against my Neumann or something.
You could do the shocked face poster frame and you won't believe what I discovered about this. I found this microphone in the loft of a friend's house from last century. You won't believe it sounded.
I'm enthusiastic, but not that enthusiastic. I need to dial that up if I ever want to make anything of myself on YouTube, really, don't I? Like that.
No, I've resisted the shocked face poster frame. I was told and told and told, you must do it. And I did a couple, and it's like, this just is so wrong on every level. It doesn't convey any of the spirit of my videos. What would be the point? You know, I may as well put a picture of somebody else.
You've also then got to point, turning around and going, and you won't believe point three. you won't believe the third thing about it. Scroll down
for
more.
Yeah, that's true.
Scroll down.
Actually, good shout.
Click left.
That's definitely it. So, Paulie, I know you've been working on your arcade, history of arcade.
Yes.
You said to me in a private communication, I hope I'm not, that you'd written like 50 cues. It's an enormous amount of stuff to put under this. Are they all have a place, or have they been sort of picked and chosen for just scenes?
No,
it's like a pool of stuff.
They pretty much all have a place. The interesting thing was, I wasn't able to have a finished thing to score, but the director and me had such a good shared cultural knowledge. Like, I'm 41, he's 47, so we have a lot of the same references in music, you know?
Right.
We're not kind of like talking at two ends of a century. And so going, I really like this. Can you do something like, you know, Hall and Oates for this scene? Can you do something like the Cocteau Twins for this scene?
Oh, nice.
And then I just went away and kind of just, you know, made a load of stuff up. He really liked it. And autism for the win, as they say, Nick, because I was just able to nail it, basically.
Excellent. Well, you know, it comes in handy. Nice one. Well, thanks very much. Let's get on to some topics. We do have some this week. And actually, the first one is... before I do that, I must let you know about this other thing. Let me see. Where is it? I just need to rewind. Here we go. Just got to throw this one up. Don't forget, we've got a competition this week. This is Sonic Couture. There's over £1,000 worth of prizes, so do check that out. Bitly, the link will be in the show notes. Do enter. Free to enter. I think you have to answer a question. And then you'll be entered for the prize draw. So, yeah, go for that. Thanks to them very much. Anyway, let's get on to a topic. Right, this is actually quite fresh because it's been official for, about 5 minutes. So let's see what happens if I press this button. I think I've loaded it properly. Yes. New Void and Vista sample library it's called Folds, based on the human voice. And their award-winning sound design engine, NI Contact and NKS compatible. It's about a bespoke collection of specially curated vocal articulation. It's really unusual. And seems to be going all the rage. And I know the last time we featured one of these, Ty was raving about it. And I did a video with them at, I think it was the last show in London. I forget the one in London. It's the Tile Yard show in London. And I had a chat with, I forget the name of the chap now, but it did sound really marvellous. £99 intro price. I'm not sure what the footprint is. Ty, I imagine you've probably already got it and used it. Interesting. It's this sort of notion of having stuff that's different to everybody else. I mean, it's a constant sort of chase for, I guess, you it folks is. Doing media composition.
Yeah, they came up about a month ago, and they did a video of just basically loading it onto. They didn't even tell me what it was, you know, what the kind of library was, and they came up and basically loaded on the machine and then just filmed me sitting down and messing around with it. And it's very easy to say these days, oh, it's amazing, it's fantastic, because you can say it about so many libraries, but it is different. And I think that's what I love about it, because it's not like your normal vocal library. It can be. I mean, there are some patches in there that are very traditional kind of choir vocal patches, pads, and there's loads of that, and some of that's very beautiful, but that's not what it's really going for. It's basically, I think it's about 6 gig, which in this day and age is, you know, not a big library, which in a way is good, because it's not just filling loads of drives with, you know, various different mic combinations that you're never going to use. All the material in there is there because it's really worthwhile and is really useful. Mm. But it's basically just really different. It's really different. It's essentially using the human voice in ways that up until now, you've had to get vocalists. This is what special it for me. You've had to hire in vocalists to come and do the special stuff. You know, the stuff that you don't get. It's not bread and butter stuff. And so you have to get people in to do it. And with this, it's literally now just in the box. It's just, and the thing is about all of their stuff, the same with Strands, is that the sound design, the programming is just really well done. It's really just cleverly done. And like you say, doing what I do, it's always trying to be one step ahead and just sound a bit different. And this library is just unbelievably different to any other vocal library that's out there. I mean, the nearest thing is kind of Exhale, and some of the vocalized stuff by Heriosity. But I tell you, the easiest way of describing it is when you get a normal vocal library, you know you'll get those one or two, I'm going to say, experimental patches at the end. And imagine that it's those two patches, except they've made an entire instrument out of those experimental patches. And it's just gorgeous. You just sit and play. The biggest test for me is you just sit and you play it, and next thing you realize, it's like 4 hours later, and it's still just
right,
messing and playing with it. It's beautiful. Amazing.
Oh, nice.
And for the money, again, yeah, very good. So...
Yeah, excellent. Well, they can't do a and I think it's on offer at the moment, £99 from 100. So it's still, you know, fairly reasonable. It's interesting. I mean, Richard, I know we've spoken to you about software stuff before. I mean, you're kind of just as much of a consumer of that stuff as anybody else. I mean, do you go for the sort of sample library stuff that has the sort of unique flavor? Is that something that you tend to
dig in? Really what I look for. And in this library, watching the video last night really grabbed me at how much emotion that those samples were able to convey in a way that I found really, really interesting. You know, I tend to listen to and write sort of darker stuff, and this really felt like it would slip right in there and allow me to do some really interesting things. So this is the first vocal sample library I've actually been like, you know what, 99, that's not bad for this, and I probably would use it because it has such a unique sound, and it just drips with emotion, which I thought was really, really cool.
That's interesting, isn't it, for samples to have that. I know, Paulie, are you a sample library person? I mean, I always find I kind of go, how many gigs? God, the built-in drives on these M1 computers is so stingy. I don't know if I can afford to put any sample libraries on it, and then it has to be on external drive, and so I tend to shy away.
Yeah,
from
I know.
It,
but, I've got an SSD hanging off my Mac at all times, essentially.
Yeah, but sense.
On a really long lead, so it can just be on the floor or somewhere miles away. So I'm not really worrying about it, you know, but of course that means like a child could step on it. So, you know, it's not an ideal solution. I like the built-in effects with this one because, you know, with anything, there's going to be some stellar presets. And ever since Digital Native Dance on the Roland D50, once it's used once by a composer... It's kind of old hat, isn't it? And it's like, oh, someone's using Digital Native Dance again. But these effects, like the lo-fi effects, character effects slot, and user convolutions. I'm all for the very first episode of Sonic Talk we ever did, Nick. I can't remember how long ago it was. 718,
sure.
I think. It was a good sort of 80 episodes ago. So I was talking about making weird convolutions of things like trains in tunnels or, you know, by FMing an existing convolution and putting it back in, seeing what that did. And that is going to open up a lot of sound design potential, you know. So
interesting.
It does seem it's very flexible, and you know, even once you get away from the presets, you can do a lot.
The amount of sound design you can do is just phenomenal. I mean, literally, you can take a patch and within 30 seconds, you've just got something that bears no resemblance to what you started really off good. With. It's just a complete different world. And I mean, just as an example, they were telling me about one patch they did where the guy who had the idea and the initial design of it had the idea of, rather than taking a vocal and then turning it granular, did the opposite. So he recorded hundreds of little granular bits of vocals and then reassembled them to make the sound. So rather than taking the That's sound great. And making it granular, he made it granular and then made a sound. And it took him weeks to do. And but it sounds amazing. So, you know, That's I did have to say cool. I did actually kind of stroke his shoulder and say, life's too short, but it was,
yeah. You know, it was just a top tip for SSDs. NVMe drives are really good these days. You can get these little enclosures for like, I don't know, they're only about £20 or something, even less, and you just put an NVMe card in them and they're really fast, most NVMEs. So I'll just pop that out. But it's worth mentioning, if rather than paying for a tip-top one, they usually have a really fast write speed and read speed compared to just regular SSDs, because SSDs are not all the same, unfortunately. Would be nice if they were, but they're not. Sometimes they don't read or write in quite the same the speeds you need. Anyway, just thought I'd throw that in there. Okay, right, let's have a look and see where we're going next. I think actually this is kind of a good one. This is a Red Reeds recording video, which it's a 40-minute video, and I'm just in awe of people who can make kind of documentaries of, because it's kind of essentially a documentary. It's sort of a love letter to Rompler pads. So I'm going to press that one and we'll see where it takes us. I won't play the whole thing because it's 42 minutes long.
I love pads. Long ones, short ones, weird ones, ones with little tinkly bits, ones with crazy bits, spooky ones, pretty ones, all of them. For me, the pad is one of the apex predators of the synthesizer world. Powerful.
I'm going to leave that statement there because that is a hell of a statement. I think in this, but it makes a good case. Nice to hear Red Reed recording kind of in more jovial mood. Sometimes he gets a bit sort of uptight about subjects, and it's, you know, it can be a bit kind of a hard watch. But this was brilliant, I thought. Absolutely brilliant. Loads of stars in there. We've got the Prophet X gets a lot of love, actually. I was really pleased at the end, which is something that it's a bit of a Marmite synth, that one, because it's still quite expensive, but it can do an awful lot of things. But just the notion that pads are this kind of like the superpower of electronic music, this whole notion of the bed that can convey almost so many things with just a note. Absolutely fantastic. And I'm guessing I have to come to you, Ty, because you probably use them an awful lot, pads generally speaking, in your term. I mean, I know you're very orchestrally complicated. What's the word I'm looking for? Able. Orchestrally able, but pads nonetheless. I mean, you can still have string pads, have the same sort of feel, but very much for soundtrack, pads are the thing, aren't they? Pads and beds.
I agree with every word. If you had to say to me what are the two or three main things, I would say strings, real strings, pads, and piano. That's basically it. And synth pads for me are and I watch this and it's all just, it's almost like he's read my mind on so many levels because I've got a lot of the stuff I've got is I have lots of pad machines, you know. I keep lots of synths just purely for pads, you know, kind of. I mean, I can't remember the last time. I mean, my wave station is just pads. I've got a Neuron Hartman that is just, I have to say, that's probably the best pad machine. That's just pads. So many pad libraries, all the Luftrum stuff, and obviously Omnisphere. It's just, I'm with him all the way. Pads are a huge part of what I do. And if you turn around to me and said, okay, you can only just sit down and play one kind of sound for hours, that it would just be slow, luscious, glorious pads. With long reverb. Yeah, that's it. That's my life.
Interesting. I'd like to put a shout out for the Baby Audio Atoms, actually, because that's kind of that's a very expressive instrument, and that can just take, that can be almost one notepad, lots of organic stuff in there. I know, Paulie, I mean, I know, you know, you've got a lot of these machines, these Romplers specifically, which are, Atoms isn't really a Rompler at all, it's a modelling synth. So I guess this was right in your wheelhouse, as it were.
I should have a badge saying, hello, my name is Paulie, and I have a problem with the amount of Romplers I own. But yeah, pads. I'm not going to disagree, am I? I love them.
No, I suppose not.
I've got a couple of favourites that I want to point out, I guess. One is, it's on my bottom row, the Psy 35. It really is terrible by any technical standards. It's got really sort of 2 megabytes of samples and 2 op FM. But for some reason, when you combine it all, it has this instant aquarium VHS soundtrack quality. if you ever went to an aquarium in the 90s and watched a video about dolphins on a screen, then probably the Psy 22 or the Psy 35 did it. And also, I've got a couple of Ensonics. I've got the VFX SD, which is just amazing for pads, and the EPS 16 Plus, which you can do kind of lots of granular stuff on. So I absolutely love a pad, and I like rolling my own on samplers as well. So sometimes I'll even sample VSTs, you know, like modern VST Romplers or modern VST digital instruments. I'll sample them into either the Korg DSS-1, which is the king of all pads in my in my mind. That DSS-1 is just absolutely incredible with its analog filters, or that analog that Akai S700 VX90 combo I've got up there.
Oh, right, it's really good. Because that had a connector, you can, didn't it, to you?
Yeah, it's got a 13-pin cable like the Roland guitar pickup, so you can run your kind of, I think it's 12-bit, is it, samples through analog filters and, you know, get some lovely results, bit of reverb, job done. So I love Rompler pads, you know. Pads in general.
Nice. Shout out in the chat from Mental Frisbee, Steinberg Pad Shop, older new version. I've not tried that, but I know that a lot of their instrument stuff is really goes under the radar. I don't know what it is about their, whether they don't sort of market it kind of strongly enough, or I guess it's a lot of, there might be a lot of secret weapons in there that people are going, no, don't tell anybody about that. What's your secret weapon or secret desire when it comes to pads? Is there a machine you reach for or a software equivalent?
For a long time, I had the Ensonic ESQ-1, and that was sort of my go-to when I wanted to make sort of crunchy, old-school pads. Nowadays, I sort of cheat because I tend to use monosynths all the time. And so what I'll do is I'll just use any poly synth in Ableton and play something out, record the MIDI, and then just go back and track one note at a time and build my own polysynths with the monos. And that gives me that depth of sound that I'm looking for that you get with those polysynths and the Romplers. I have the luxury of doing this as a hobbyist and not as a professional musician. So if it takes me 4 hours to track one pad line using a monosynth, I enjoy the process. So maybe not the best way to go about it for everybody, but for me, it's really enjoyable. You know, you tweak it a little bit between each pass. So it just, as you add layers and layers, it just gets bigger and bigger, and it gives me that same sort of warm feeling inside. I like it.
Absolutely. I just got to say also, obviously we got, let me see if I can get that to light. Yeah. Chemflux Pierce. Use the Hydrosynth. I have to say, the Hydrosynth is an awesome pad machine. I was just looking back at some videos I shot of that. I did something with Glenn Darcy where we explored the FM capabilities of the modifiers, or what are they called? Can't remember what they're called. Mutants. There's the mutators. That's right.
Mutators. That's it.
I'd forgotten just how much you can throw at that, because there's so many oscillators and so many envelopes and so many LFOs, so many mutators. You just kind of literally go, oh, what about if I do this? And what about if I do? And then just that's a pad synthesis dream. That machine actually still. I mean, it's amazing that they've still not released anything other than stuff based around that pure engine. It must be five years, and it's still going strong. You know, the form factors still work. I mean, you can pick up the Hydrosynth engine for a reasonable amount of money now, just for, if you get the little one, you know, which has still got poly aftertouch as well. Yeah, that's a good shout, Hydrosynth. I don't know if that features, I guess it's not, is it a Rompler? It's not, is it? Because it's, I think the wave tables, would that count as a Rompler or not? Yes.
Technically, yes.
Official. Technically, yes.
If the wave tables are stored in ROM, then it technically is a ROM. There's interpolation and crossfading going on, but the thing is, though, I dislike that Rompler became a dirty word in synthesis. Or do I like it actually? Because it allows me to blow people's minds and expectations away when I, you know, show them some patches and on like a J. I did a video on the JV and XV series, you know, and got loads of ring mod going and cool stuff, and people were like, oh my goodness. I guess I kind of like it. It allows me to dig in and find some gold in these abandoned instruments that everyone used, you know, years ago and kind of don't use that much anymore. But I kind of dislike it, and I think it's just a tool like any other, isn't it, really? A Rompler.
Ken Fletcher Pierce says technically no, I'm afraid. There's a contradiction there, so I'll let you back.
Oh,
you
can
duke it out in the chat room.
We'll take it onto
the Discord later. Take it outside, fellas.
Roll up my sleeve.
I'll tell you another one. Just thinking of all the machines that I kind of over the years used that are amazing for pads. The two EMUs, the Morpheus and the Audity 2000. Do you remember those?
Yes, I've got one. I've got an Ultra Proteus, which has got the Morpheus filters in it. Wow.
They're not
just
quite,
absolutely wild.
They're slightly different on the actual Morpheus, because I've got 2500 as well. Especially those filters and what you can do, the movement you can do with it is just... Yeah, that's one that's just kind of slipped under the net, and people forget it even exists. But
that's probably something you can build. There were so many different flavors of EMU Rompler, weren't there? There was the Proteus, the Proteus 2000, the Proteus World. I mean, it was just sort of, you could have filled best part of a big 19U rack with just variants of Proteus Rompler, I think. And people did. I do remember the original Proteus. Was it the Proteus 2000, which was that grey thing that just had a tiny... It was worse
Proteus
than a D110. Proteus 1, was it?
Proteus
that was
1.
A nightmare. But it was considered to be a pretty groundbreaking for the time. I guess it had a lot of ROM in it. I guess, I don't know.
It did. It was all from the Emulator 3 series, I think. So they were good quality samples. And I've got... I showed it a few weeks back.
4 meg.
Four meg,
yeah. I've got an expansion card, internal sound card based on the Proteus, which is really cool, which I've got to do a video on at some point. Because it would have been mind-blowing in like the late 80s to just have all those sounds just in your computer with no external gear. Pretty cool.
Can those things be run on the kind of the DSP, the 5600, the 56K emulators that we've been talking about recently? Could you, if you got the image, could you do that? Or is it the hard part would be getting hold of the actual PCM, I suppose, wouldn't it, in that instance? Because
a lot of these early EMU NN Sonic units actually used custom chips. Like, for instance, NSonic used the DOC chip. And then I think it was the DOC 2 and the DOC 3 chips. So it's kind of a different architecture to the DSP 56K stuff. But I liked the question, and I like getting nerdy about DSP.
Yeah, fair enough.
That was actually that was actually one thing I liked about the video was the Red Means recording videos. He showed the VST equivalents for all these classic romplers. So yes, if you had if you heard a sound in there, you heard something that really caught your ear, he gave you a way to use it in a modern situation, which I thought was really the best part of the video. It's like, oh, I could try this without having to go onto Reverb and buy a ridiculous synth. I can do this in a VST, which I thought was really nice.
But no, just that is a good one. You're absolutely right, but I will just say, if anyone is really into pads, just go and look up Luftrum 2. A contact instrument, but it is literally just, it's all it is pads. That's all it is. There's nothing other than gigs and gigs and gigs and gigs and gigs of pads. And it's just an instant. You struggle to make it sound bad. Every patch, it's just like patch after patch after patch of just gorgeous pads. So
nice,
beautiful.
Yeah. But yeah, it's kind of slipped under the net again. People don't really know it that well. Yeah, Luftrum.
Well, there's so much there. That's part of the problem, isn't it? It's kind of, there's so much out there now that it's kind of quite hard to be noticed, I suppose, in many ways. Mm-hmm. Which is why you need advertising on a podcast such as ours, he said rather crassly, but I'm going to go there now. This is a message from our friends over at Native Instruments. Right. Let's think, where else do we go? Okay. Oh yeah, I'm going to go here because I think this will probably chime. I'm starting to pun. I'm punning away. I don't know how I'm managing to do it. This sort of chime or vibe. It's going to vibe. This is vibing, I guess, isn't it? Or is it marimbering? I can't remember what was in the video. Yeah, this is a really interesting hypnotic piece. 15 pieces, 15 notes, all recorded at 0.2 BPM variance to a metronome separately and then just lined up and played. And this is by a chap called Jeremy Carrier, who's primarily a vibes player or tuned percussion by the looks of it. And he's been exploring the concept of rhythmical phase. And it's honestly, once you start kind of tuning into it, it's almost impossible not to just lose yourself in it. I can't imagine how dull it might have been to make, but the results themselves are impressive. But imagine trying to play this live. It would be so, 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 so hard. But he does loads of really interesting rhythmical pieces as well. You should check out his stuff. I'll plug this up. This is an album he's just posted. And I think I can just... maybe I can't. It hasn't shown up. Never mind. I love this. I thought it was really good. This is another one of Midiera's great finds. And it's just... A lot of his stuff's really good, but it develops really. I mean, the cyclical phase based stuff. It's almost like systems music, but it's wrong. Systems is usually all on the same tempo. Usually, just beat divisions are different. But I'm going to come to you first, Ty, because I know you studied this kind of thing. Is it a musical thing? I mean, it seems like it's sort of.
It's a totally musical thing, and it's not. It's a totally musical thing, and I love it, absolutely love it. But it's all been done before. I mean, it was done in the 60s.
Ah, okay, right.
So this started. This is all based on the kind of stuff that Steve Reich started with his tape pieces, where essentially he had wrote two pieces, one called Come Out and one called It's Gonna Rain, and basically he got two reel to reels and gradually slowed one down, and because he found out accidentally that when you put two tapes, although they're meant to be the same speed, they gradually start to drift, and that forms all of these they obviously the rhythms gradually stretch. So that's how that one started. And then he's actually started writing pieces that weren't just the obviously clapping song. That's the famous one, and that is, as you say, one of the players gradually drifts by a quaver. And so essentially they go completely out of sync, and then about 7 or 8 minutes later, they come back into sync. But then he started writing phase pieces where it's exactly like this. You basically have players who one gradually slows down, not in a set rhythmic pattern. He gradually slows down, and then again, eventually, cyclically, they get back into sync again. And they're really difficult to play and play well.
Oh, God,
but I've actually
imagine.
Got friends... I've got a friend called Ian Blick who actually did piano phase, but did it himself. So basically had one hand on one piano, one hand on another piano, and basically slowed down one hand. So not two players with one creditor.
Oh my goodness.
He played them. He played them and gradually slowed down the one. And
wow,
he blew my mind when he did it. Yeah, it is. He's a fantastic musician. So this isn't new in the slightest, but is it fantastic? I mean, this is literally like you could have, when I saw these topics today, it was just like, Nick, have you been planning a show for me all along? And it's just, you just want things that I want to talk about. Yeah, because, yeah, wow. this kind of music, I'm a huge Steve Reich fan. And so if this does appeal to anyone, go and check out Steve Reich. He's written so many amazing pieces over the years, Different Trains and Drumming and so many ensemble pieces. And it's all based on this kind of idea of rhythmic patterns that gradually phase out and come back into phase and rhythmic shifting. And absolutely brilliant. And just fantastic. And check out Clapham. I made the mistake, the biggest mistake I ever made. I took a girlfriend to the Albert Hall and she thought she was going to a classical concert. And it was a classical concert, but it was actually a Steve Reich concert. And the opening number was Clapping Song. And not Clapping Song, Clapping. And after the piece finished, she just turned around to me. I can't say the exact because it was quite sweary. But the sentiment was, why the hell have you brought me to see this rubbish? That's the clean version.
Right.
It was a lot dirtier than that. And that was after the first piece. And what I didn't tell her was there was another 2.5 hours of this to come. It wasn't the best date in the world, I have to say. Yeah. So. Yeah,
best to find out.
But Steve Reich, absolutely. Steve Reich, absolutely fantastic. And what this guy's done is brilliant. Yeah. So,
I suppose, Richard, this is like system stuff, isn't it? I mean, there's that that Soma Cosmos, the looper that has kind of loops that drifting station, where they in the original firmware, the loops just sort of gradually drift out. But I don't know whether there's any. But there might be some kind of software idea for this where you could actually just have a little more control over it so that the ratios between the tempo changes could lead to all sorts of interesting stuff. I'm not sure what musical applications, but you might be able to get some loops that you then repeat on the beat, which would be useful, but it's fascinating stuff.
The whole point is you don't repeat it on the beat.
Well, I suppose, yeah. Rich, you're muted, I think, Richard. You seem to be.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, I found this, I found it sort of hypnotizing to watch. And just like you said, as I was watching it, I was thinking, how could you relate this to some sort of controller, some sort of sequencer in a way that, because sequencers, you sort of have a limited palette of what's expected that they could do. You have things like human feel, where you can have them drifting in and out, and you can have notes play or not play, and you can change whether they maybe ratchet or things like that. But this was an interesting way to start thinking about timing and maybe a little bit differently than I have in the past. And it definitely got me thinking of how could you incorporate this type of idea into a hardware sequencer or a software sequencer that maybe can spur some musical ideas. I found it fascinating. I ended up watching this with headphones on twice as I was sort of thinking through my ideas. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I guess you could do it with LFOs, couldn't you? So if you have free-running LFOs, so you had a lot of LFOs that all start on a note trig, and then you just say, well, LFO 1 is that tempo, and LFO 6 is this one, and then they just sort of spread between them and then just gradually go out. And I suppose if they were... maybe, I don't know what they would be. They'd have to be almost kind of like trigger LFOs or something that would kind of, you could do it in analog. I mean, it'd be quite a monster patch, I'd imagine, but it's certainly something you could do.
No, that's true. Two LFOs that are slightly off from each other would create something very similar to that. And then applying that to maybe pitch in addition to the tempo, and maybe note length in addition to just the tempo. I think there's a lot of really interesting ways that you could apply variances to sequences that maybe aren't explored as often as they should be.
Mm. Yeah, and I'm sure that you could apply the same thing to modulation, because we're thinking about it at a more of a wide level, but on a macro scale where those cycles are all shorter and modulating, it could be interesting. I don't know, Paulie, just because you can, yes, does it mean you should?
You definitely should. Yeah, you definitely should just try and push the boundaries and explore as much as possible. Unfortunately, I had a number of Steve Reich factoids prepared for this part, but Ty's said them all.
Oh, sorry.
Pipped you.
But that's okay, that's fine. No, the one thing I wanted to say was... It's the jeopardy of going first or last or blah, blah, blah on Phonicon. At university, we did a couple of his pieces as performance projects. So we did a lot of composition, but we also had to do set group performances. And we had a guitar ensemble. So we did guitar phase, which was a later rearrangement of his 60s piece Violin Phase, and that's very much, you know, going out of time, but it's on guitars, and it was fun, you know, and it came out a bit different to the tape versions of his pieces, due to,
yeah,
obviously,
because it's human rather
the unpredictability
than...
of human, kind of, you know. And when we first started practicing it, we'd actually kind of do it more in kind of semi-quavers, some of the shifts, different parts to get those feelings. And then we try and do it a bit more incrementally. And the other one we did was Electric Counterpoint, which I think is for something like 15, 16, 17 guitars. But there were only 6 or 7 of us. So we kind of, you know, improvised, and you know, we got really.
If you all had delay pedals. If you all had a delay pedal, it would have worked, couldn't it?
That's it. Yeah.
Doubled
definitely.
Up.
So I like a bit of Reich.
Yeah.
It's really cool stuff. I am not a minimalist at all. In my musical style, I'm very more is more. My wife says, right, you'll have more is more written on your grave. But I've kind of learnt, as I've kind of chilled out over the years, that, yeah, maybe
there can be
spaces. Some of it's... I think earlier in my kind of musicality, I was really, really keen to show all this crazy, packed-in genius per square inch of music. And now I kind of let my music breathe a bit more. So one day I might write a minimalist piece, you know, when I'm like 80 or something.
always just remember it's what you don't say rather than what you say.
Yes.
That's what I was always taught that from a very early in composition. It's not what you do say, it's what you don't say. And it's not the notes, it's the space.
It's the space. Well, we've all heard that before.
I'll learn that eventually.
I think that there was another thing that I wanted to get to, if everybody's got time for it. This is an interesting one, I think, just fully for all, and kind of ties in a little bit with you having a pair of monitors delivered, Ty. So, you know, maybe it'll maybe you'll run everything through this. Let's see.
It's my show again.
So this is a club synth sound system, G-Sonic club sound system. It's an interesting idea. I don't know how close it is to, you know, to what it is, because I don't have all those PA systems, but the idea is you're supposed to be able to dial in a kind of club sound system, and it'll be the acoustic space, that how crappy the tops are, the mids, the crossover points. They call it advanced IR responsive modelling technology, also amplifiers and passive high performance speakers, limiters, multiband. You know, they say they've gone in quite deep to it, so you can check your mix. And you can hear there's quite a lot of difference to these things. And I'm just curious whether how useful something like this is like to be and how close it is, because we've seen these kind of virtual studio environments that you work with headphones, which definitely kind of, this is definitely sounds better on headphones. Anyway, it's like 29.9 euros. And I think it might be something that could be useful, because we don't often get to hear music on a PA. You know, when you do, sometimes it's a terrible shock. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's like, oh, that's good. Sometimes you think, damn, I should have put that high pass filter across the vocal, because all I can hear is the tube train or whatever, you know, maybe. I don't know. I mean, speaker emulations are an interesting thing, aren't they? And they definitely have their use. Do you think, I mean, have you tried that method of sort of trying mixes in spaces you don't have or on speakers you don't have? And has it proved useful to you?
For a while, I was using some of those headphone, mixing your headphone, emulating speakers, and you could try different speakers emulating in your headphones. And I always thought they sounded terrible. I don't know. I never trusted what I was hearing in the headphones, because it seemed like the software always sounded a little bit different. So I think it just, for me, it just comes down to understanding my speakers and knowing, trusting that I know what that's going to translate to. I listened to this Club System emulator, and you know, with headphones on, it sounded like they were just EQing differently. Now, I'm not the guy to ask about this. I don't go out clubbing very often, and my music never gets played there, so it's not really for me. But I found it interesting that they felt like that's. I'm sure it helped somebody.
Yeah, well, I guess if you're putting your stuff together. No, I'm absolutely. I'll tell you one thing I did. I tried the Waves NX thing, where you have the thing on top of your headphones and your head position changes the stereo. That was really quite remarkable, because your brain was fooled to thinking, I'm listening in this environment, even though you had headphones on and you had a nice picture of the studio. And I did find that in some instances, I felt like I was understanding the low-end response better. I mean, this is a static thing, so I don't know that it's how useful it is. And it sounded quite raw in places. I mean, I don't know, Paulie, you may listen to some of your stuff in clubs. I mean, your stuff is kind of quite dense, like you say, it's not minimal, and sometimes club stuff needs to be minimal to get the most out of a system.
Sure.
So it could sound a bit messy, you know, if you've got too much going on in a system like this.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do reference mixes all the time in, you know, different spaces, headphones. In the car is such a good one for hearing if you've got your low end under control, because, you know, it'll really show up, you know, any sort of rogue vibrations. I don't essentially write club music, but I guess you could use this, and if you knew the kind of properties of the place you were trying to get your track played in, I guess it could help you nail that, well, not audition, but nail that kind of, you know, communication with a DJ who tries it out and goes, oh, this is good. So it could be a tool that maybe gets you over the kind of finishing line. But then again, DJs have EQs, don't they? So, and if they really like the musical content of a track, they might more likely just kind of tweak the EQ a bit. And that might be more important than the
that's
EQ.
True. They're probably just going to loop the intro anyway and play it over something else. Yeah.
That's it. The other thing is, there's a few variables they haven't emulated, like how sticky the floor is. I'm sure that has, you know, that club gunk, horrible, sticky floor. I'm sure that has acoustic properties to it. And also the annoying person in the booth trying to yell into the DJ's headphones, a request or what are you doing? And maybe they should overlay that on the top, because DJs might have to kind of listen through that.
Is the track any good? I think it'd be interesting, because I recently did a headphone review of the Sennheiser MD490s, which are the Pro. And one thing I was really struck by was the low end in them, actually, to me, because somebody, Technomatic said, misses the point of a club system, which is making your entire body vibrate. Those headphones sound like there's a sub in the room. You feel the bass in your chest, which is a really weird psychoacoustic property of a pair of headphones. So I wonder if listening, you know, depending on what you're listening to this emulation on, I mean, I don't know, Ty, I mean, you famously spent quite a lot of time trying to find the right studio speakers, but I imagine your stuff you don't hear in the clubs. But I mean, you know, the stuff you did with Midge, you know, you would have heard those on really big systems. Did that translate well, or were you thinking, oh, I'm not sure, or...
No, I think this is something that you kind of learn with time. And when I look back on years when I had, you know, I wasn't fortunate enough to have really, I just had average monitors, and you have to grow to learn them and trust them. But what I've learned is, as the years, you know, you manage to get better monitors and better speakers, you just learn to trust them more and more and more, to the extent that, I just kind of now trust these beyond belief. I mean, but even on the MM12s, you've basically got some DSP, so you can switch it to different modes, and there's a kind of, you can do NS10, and I'm sure it's just EQ. I don't think there's any genuine real heavy duty DSP going on. I think it's just EQ, but you can switch into kind of an NS10 mode and a hi-fi mode and a, but this technology has been around for so long. I mean, I had, back in the day, do you remember the Roland VM7200 series? Do you remember this VM, the modular?
Were those...
You had the faders and these weren't monitors, these were mixers. So basically the VM7200, you had I had two controllers. So you had 48 channels of fader, and then you had all the actual ins and outs were on rack mounts. And they had speaker emulation. So we're talking now in the 90s. And so you had speaker emulation in them. And the only reason they were really good was because at that stage, my monitors weren't... what I would call trustworthy. It meant, for bearing in mind what I was doing, I really wanted to know what it sounded like on a TV. That was my main thing. Yeah. So I used to forever be mixing, making it sound good, and then switching into, you know, on the 7200, put it into TV mode as a reference. And that was glorified EQ. I don't think there's anything really fancy going on other than that. But it's another reference. And I remember exactly everyone was saying, is the fact that you basically have to take it to other speaker systems, whether it be a car, whether it be just we used to call them boom boxes, you know, just something like that, or over a Bluetooth speaker, or just to kind of see if anything jumps out. That's the thing. So this is, if you're going to have stuff playing at a club, I am absolutely, my music is never going to be so not club orientated. But if you have something that is, this would be really useful, simply because it will make you hear if something is sticking out, if something is or too quiet. Yeah. I mean, the famous one that we always used to do, and you know this one because everyone should do it in everything they do, every studio. Basically, once you've got a mix that sounds about right, you go and you open the door and you stand outside and listen to the mix from the outside in. And because what that does is, again, it will make anything that's wrong jump out at you. And that's the whole point of what this is. So if you have stuff played at clubs, this is fantastic. Not for me. But all I'd say is, it is one of those things, because it took me years, because just like everybody else, if you're turning around and you have a limited budget, and you want, what you want, what is exciting? Is it exciting to buy a pair of speakers, or is it exciting to buy a new synth? And I would for years always buy the new synth. So the synth would be worth a couple of grand, and the things I was listening to it on would be like 200 quid. And it took me years to realize that if you do it properly and doing it seriously, it should be the speakers that are in the thousands and the synths that are lower down. Because, you know, I'm fortunate now, my monitors, I just trust. And so I don't do any reference on anything else now. I don't have to, because if they sound good here, I know they sound, you know, kind of good everywhere else. But that takes a lot of, it takes a lot to get to that. But I know speakers are not sexy, but they're not sexy, but they're really worth spending the money on. They really are. So
the thing that's interesting about the new breed of speakers, I think, I mean, just as an aside, is, you know, the new, there's the IK iLoud Studios, which I thought sounded fantastic. We had a pair of these Graham Audio BBC monitors, which were just, it was like a religious experience listening to music on them. Honestly, we had this happen with various people we'd bring in, and they'd go, oh, we've got to listen to these. They're not here anymore, but because they were just so expensive, I was just so nervous about moving anything and scratching them that I just thought. Yeah, but they're $10,000 passive speakers. So, you know, but it's like having a PA in the room with the extended bass frequency of the imagery in the top. It was the most astonishing sound. And so you listen to music that you think you know intimately, and you just go, what's this? I've never heard this before. It was so revealing, but beautiful to listen to, because I also don't like listening to kind of clinical studio monitors, because I don't find it enjoyable. I find it like unpleasant, and I know that's part of the experience. But I like to get a sort of emotional response from the music I'm listening to, and I can't get that on. It's generally the more sort of German studio monitors, which are very sort of clean and precise, and they don't mess about. I prefer the sound of like the IKs and the sound of the things that have a bit more vibe to them, but still will reveal things that you just thought, goodness me, I've never heard that before. And I agree. I mean, but I think it's down to the speakers. I mean, these things are the BBC ones are absolutely bizarre. They're called Graham Audio. I think they're LS5s. And they've got a 12-inch sub, a mid-range speaker, which has got like this slot. No, the sub has got a slot in it. So it's got a piece of wood with a kind of like a letterbox like this. And you think, what's that doing? And it's like, because for many, many years, there were loads of boffins at the BBC studios whose only job was to make speakers sound good in their studios. So you're talking about sort of 30 years of research that's gone by the wayside, and they've just taken the patent and sort of tweaked it a little bit and made it makeable. And it's astonishing. And we actually had one, they brought another pair up, said, I'll try these because these are a bit more beaten up and we don't want, you know. And They sounded wrong, and it was because there was this sort of tiny bit of wood missing from this baffle. It was just ludicrous, but it made a massive difference. So this level of science and is impressive. But I suppose my point was, together with the DSP that you could get in speakers, you could have really astonishing sounding speakers for much less than you used to have to pay. Just depends on whether or not, you know, they've got latency and all the other issues, and you know what your room sounds like and all that kind of stuff. So it's well worth spending. But the headphones as well got improved massively. You know, the listening environment.
You're completely right, but it is just that you kind of, again, but headphones are unsexy. But until you actually have an amazing pair, you don't really realise. I just went for years of spending loads on synths and nothing on speakers, nothing on headphones, and now in hindsight, you just think, oh God, I've just been an idiot. Because at the end of the day, it's the speakers and the headphones that actually are the final link in the chain before it gets to our ears. Do you know what I mean? So it's
well, that's true.
But they're not. But sexy. I suppose they're not sexy. That's all.
No, but the thing is you're not gonna. The headphones aren't going to help you write the killer bass line that's going to make the track that sort of tops the charts. Maybe. I mean, you know, I suppose that's the aspirational. It depends on what you're doing. I know it's a fascinating subject. Could talk for hours on it, but I think we maybe have come to the end of our allotted time. I appreciate you all hanging in there. I think we'll wrap things up now, if that's okay. We've got a couple of topics left over for next week, just in case there's no news, but I'm sure there will be. I want to say, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. Are you back into kind of designing the world's greatest neck synthesizer now, and or did you get a bit of a break?
I did take a week off. It was very relaxing, and now we're back in it. I'm actually, we have a release coming out at Superbooth, so I'm deep in preparing documentation and videos and text and all that for that. So it's a treadmill that never stops.
Yes. I suppose you could put it that way. But anyway, lovely to have you. And Ty, nice to have you as well. Are you back to straight into VT and composing, yep, or have you got the rest of the day off?
I'm going to go and plug these Key 3s in, and then I will.
Oh, nice.
Then, yeah, so I'm going to have some fun with those for a few hours, and then I'll be back to work. But no,
will you be tempted to check your mixes on those other speakers now you've got such nice hi-fi speakers?
Possibly. Yeah. Possibly. Yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah. But they do. I should actually just say it was you actually that pointed me in the direction of those, you know, kind of initially. So thank you for that. I do appreciate it. So,
that's all right. Yeah. They've got a very, like you say, there's a very good, they're very emotionally rewarding speakers to listen to.
Absolutely.
I think would be the thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Paulie, thanks for joining us too. I guess you're back to childcare, juggling childcare work and finishing a soundtrack and stuff.
Yeah, I've got a bit of time off from the soundtrack, so I've got a couple of things. From the great high fidelity chatter we've just had, I'm going to be doing some very lo-fi trashy things this week. So I've got a video nearly done about using your Commodore Amiga is a real-time guitar effect, 8-bit, 22 kilohertz, and it sounds trashy as hell, so that's great. And I think I'm going to stream the Kawai K5 later this week as well, which is kind of an early digital additive, quite noisy but quite beautiful synth. So yeah, I'm going to be in kind of lo-fi land this next week, so that's me basically.
There's a title. Welcome to Lo-Fi Land. That sounds like there could be a theme park, possibly, or some kind of one of those charming little French family-run adventure parks where the health and safety is questionable, but it has its own charm, and you could call it Lo-Fi Land. That sounds good. Anyway, folks, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure as ever. We'll see all of you folks, and thanks to everybody in the chat room for their continued involvement. Lovely to see you. We'll see you all next time. Take it easy. Bye-bye now.
Bye.